this is a special podcast of the National Secular Society's Secularism 2012 Conference, which took place on the 22nd of September 2012. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion, which is a weekly news magazine podcast about interesting things. From politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical, rationalist, pro-secularist point of view. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion at poddelusion.co.uk. In this podcast, we'll hear from Professor Richard Dawkins. He doesn't really need an introduction, does he? But, you know, he's a world-famous atheist, having authored several books on popularising the theory of evolution. He studies ethology, which is the study of animal behaviour and evolutionary biology. He was the Professor for Public Understanding of Sciences from 1995 to 2008 at Oxford University, and now, having retired from this position, he now travels internationally, giving lectures and making documentaries to increase atheism awareness. So now, here's Professor Dawkins.
Well, coming as I am at the end of the day, I thought I would begin by making a few remarks about a couple of the other talks that we've been listening to. My general title is Respect, and I'm going to be dealing with various different aspects of the respect that we are sometimes asked to give to religion. Nick Cohen talked about the difference between de jure and de facto censorship, and made the point that we are made by fear to, in effect, self-censor. And I have great sympathy with anybody who is actually physically afraid to challenge violent people. What I would encourage people to say is something like this: I fear you because you are mad. But don't for one microsecond confuse fear with respect. I do not respect you, I despise you. I fear you not because of anything remotely close to respect. I fear you only because you are behaving like a spoiled brat having a temper tantrum. Mariam Namazi gave a characteristically courageous talk. What I would say about what she said is that Sharia law is not just unjust, which of course it is, it also offends logic and reason. I mean, why shouldn't I declare Dawkinsian law? Why should religion be privileged to have its own version of law cutting across the law of the land? Now, the defense might be offered that anybody can go to arbitration, can go to moderation, and can choose to have a civil dispute moderated by somebody that both parties respect. But there are two problems with that. One is that especially women, but perhaps others as well, may not realize they even have the choice. There are many people in this country who are subject to domination by domineering male relatives, often male relatives, and not realize that they have the choice of going to the proper law of the land rather than going to the private Sharia court, which their family urges them to do. I can't remember what the other point was that I was going to make about that. It'll come to me in a moment. Peter Tatchell, I would agree that religion is the greatest threat to liberty today, but I think it's also the greatest threat to scientific truth, which is the thing that concerns me a great deal. So, should we respect faith? I don't think so. Not a crumb of respect, not a grain. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't respect individual religious people, individual faith heads. They are people, they're deluded for all sorts of understandable reasons, many of them very nice people, very kind people, very good people. We should respect them, but not their beliefs. Now, Phil Plait, who calls himself the bad astronomer, gave a talk at a TAM conference in America a couple of years ago, which had a lot of influence, and he called his talk "Don't Be a Dick." And it was aimed at people like me. And I would agree, we don't want to be a dick. But don't shrink from hurting people's feelings if their beliefs make them not worthy of not respect, but if their beliefs are not worthy of respect. Don't hesitate to say, along with Johann Hari, I respect you as a person too much to respect your ridiculous beliefs. So to concede that you're incapable of changing your mind if confronted by a reasoned argument, that's patronizing and condescending. So I would perhaps rephrase Johann Hari's remark in a more positive way and say, I respect you so much as a person that I believe you will change your mind if presented with overwhelming evidence and rational argument. At the TAM conference, where Phil Plate gave his talk called Don't Be a Dick, he asked people to put up their hands to say, when they changed their minds and left religion and became non-religious, did they change their minds as a result of being called an idiotic retard? Well, obviously, not many people said yes, but I think that's a ludicrously loaded question. What if you're not the person whose beliefs are being attacked at the moment, but, say, a third party who's listening in on the conversation? Many of the conversations that I have with very devout religious people are on radio, on television, where there's a large audience listening in. And I'm not actually trying to convert the person that I'm talking to. I probably have given up on that. What I'm doing is trying to influence other people who are listening in, people who are sitting on the fence, perhaps people who haven't thought about it very much, people who perhaps didn't even realize there was a fence to sit on. And sometimes, even if it really is your beliefs that are being ridiculed, that can be influential. I myself, as a young man, was highly influenced by Teilhard de Chardin, the French Jesuit priest, his book, The Phenomenon of Man. And even now, I can sort of dimly understand why I was influenced. It has a poetic style, a prose poetic style, which chimed in with my youthful, wide-eyed enthusiasm for the mysteries of science. I read Teilhard avidly. I'm afraid to say he even influenced my writing style as an undergraduate writing essays at Oxford. And it was at the height of my infatuation with Teilhard de Chardin that I read Peter Medawar's review of The Phenomenon of Man, which I think is a candidate for the most devastating critical book review ever written. Medawar cured me completely by ridicule. He ridiculed beliefs that I held at the time. Perhaps I felt a little bit personally assaulted to see a book that I'd treasured so effectively skewered, eviscerated, but he didn't ridicule it enough to make me stop reading his wonderful review. On the contrary, his ridicule eventually made me ashamed that I'd previously been taken in. I'll read a few extracts from this splendid review. The phenomenon of man cannot be read without a feeling of suffocation, a gasping and flailing around for sense. There is an argument in it, to be sure, a feeble argument, abominably expressed, and this I shall expound in due course. But consider first the style, because it is the style that creates the illusion of content, and which is a cause, as well as merely a symptom, of Teilhard's alarming apocalyptic seizures. The phenomenon of man stands square in the tradition of Naturphilosophie, a philosophical indoor pastime of German origin, which does not seem, even by accident, there's a great deal of it, to have contributed anything of permanent value to the storehouse of human thought. French is not a language that lends itself naturally to the opaque and ponderous idiom of nature philosophy, and Teilhard has accordingly resorted to the use of that tipsy, euphoristic prose poetry, which is one of the more tiresome manifestations of the French spirit. It would have been a great disappointment to me if vibration did not make itself felt, for all scientific mystics either vibrate in person or find themselves resonant with cosmic vibrations. But I'm happy to say that on page 266, Teilhard will be found to do so. How have people come to be taken in by the phenomenon of man? We must not underestimate the size of the market for works of this kind, for philosophy fiction. Just as compulsory primary education created a market catered for by cheap dailies and weeklies, so the spread of secondary and latterly tertiary education has created a large population of people, often with well-developed literary and scholarly tastes, who have been educated far beyond their capacity to undertake analytical thought. It is through their eyes that we must attempt to see the attractions of Tyard. Well, as a young undergraduate, you could imagine that stung a bit. It was ridicule. It was ridiculing something that I held dear, and the ridicule hit home, and I saw the light. So, although I'm not on the whole advocating ridicule, certainly not in a vituperative, vicious way, far from it. There are some websites which we're all familiar with that I wouldn't touch with a barge pole now because of their really horrible language. It's not satirical ridicule, it's not witty, it's just plain obscenity. But I do think that witty ridicule, along the lines of I've just been quoting from P.B. Medawar, can be extremely effective, certainly on third parties listening in, but also even on the victim themselves. There are times when, for political reasons, for reasons of political tactics, it's expedient to make common cause with religious leaders. And I think several of the speakers today have made this point, and I don't dissent from that. I myself have joined forces with the then Bishop of Oxford, Richard Harries, to fight creationist education in England. The bishop and I enlisted half a dozen bishops and a similar number of fellows of the Royal Society to write a letter to Tony Blair about the infamous creationist school in Gateshead. Tony Blair, I'm sorry to say, brushed it off without taking any notice. But anyway, we did make common cause, and I applaud various other scientists who have done the same thing. Perhaps the best of them is Eugenie Scott with her NCSE, National Committee for Science Education, who regard the fight for evolution in American education as so important that they are prepared, indeed eager, to compromise with religious faith. And I applaud Eugenie. I'm friends with her. But she's just actually been awarded the Richard Dawkins Award by the AAI, the American Alliance for... What is it? American Atheist Alliance, I think it's now called. But for me, evolution, important as it is to me, is only a battle in a larger war, the larger war for rational, critical thought. To quote Sam Harris, "The goal is not to get more Americans to merely accept the truth of evolution or any other scientific theory. The goal is to get them to value the principles of reasoning and educated discourse that now make a belief in evolution obligatory. Doubt about evolution is merely a symptom of an underlying condition. The condition is faith itself. Conviction without sufficient reason. Hope mistaken for knowledge. Bad ideas protected from good ones. Good ideas obscured by bad ones. Wishful thinking elevated to a principle of salvation." So to conclude this first part of my talk, respect religious people as people. Don't respect the very idea of faith. I now want to turn to a political issue which is very germane because we're just coming up to an important American election. Given that we're not going to respect faith, but we are going to respect people, should we be free, should journalists be free to question the faith of a political leader who's standing for election, or should politicians be allowed to hide behind the privacy of faith and refuse to discuss it, talking only about their policies, economic policies, foreign policy, and so on? Well, Britain and America, of course, are very different in the way our politicians treat religion. Tony Blair, at least under the forceful direction of Alistair Campbell, did not do God. He's changed his mind in retirement, and I may have time to come on to that. On the other hand, his great friend George W. Bush did God in a big way, even to the extent of listening to God's advice to invade Iraq. God would tell me, George, go and end the tyranny in Iraq. David Cameron's government has explicitly departed from the Alistair Campbell policy, we don't do God, as rather foolishly articulated by Baroness Wasi, then chairman of the Conservative Party, now Minister for Faith and Communities, whatever that means, has explicitly said, we know what communities means, it's a euphemism for Islam. We do God. She said that in that very phrase. Now, as I say, because an American election is looming very soon, I'm going to switch now for a while to talking about American issues, because I think they affect the whole of the world. In America, as you know, every politician has to do God on pain of almost certainly losing the election if he doesn't. On the other hand, the separation of church and state is deeply woven into the DNA of America. Unlike here, of course, where we have an established church, bishops as ex officio members of parliament, and so on. The American Constitution is remarkably clear on this. No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. John Kennedy, when he was standing for election, famously laid this principle on the line. He said, "I believe in a president whose religious views are his own private affair, neither imposed by him upon the nation or imposed by the nation upon him as a condition to holding office." Now, it's of course absolutely right that no religious test should be imposed before a candidate is allowed to stand for election, but that's very different from saying that voters should be forced to ignore a candidate's religious beliefs when deciding whether to vote for him. In this country, of course, we have no such reluctance to ban candidates for election. English common law clearly states that idiots are disqualified from election to parliament. I learned this only a week ago. Make of that what you will. However, in America, as I say, discriminating against anybody's eligibility to stand for election goes right against the spirit of the American Constitution. Amazingly, however, in 7 states, atheists are explicitly debarred by law. For example, the state constitution of North Carolina, Article 6, Section 8, states, "The following persons shall be disqualified for office. First, any person who shall deny the being of Almighty God." Similar laws in Arkansas. "No person who denies the being of a God shall hold any office in the civil department of this state, nor be competent to testify as a witness in any court." Maryland, Article 37. "That no religious test ought ever to be required as a qualification for any office of profit or trust in the state, other than a declaration of belief in the existence of God." Pennsylvania, Article 1. "No person who acknowledges the being of a God and a future state of rewards and punishments shall, on account of his religious sentiments, be disqualified to hold any office, so long as he acknowledges the being of a God." South Carolina, Article 17. "No person who denies the existence of a supreme being shall hold any office under this Constitution." Tennessee, Article 9. "No person who denies the being of God or a future state of rewards and punishments shall hold any office in the civil department of this state." Texas, which is a very big, important, populous state. Article 1, Section 4. "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust in this state, nor shall anyone be excluded from holding office on account of his religious sentiments, provided he acknowledge the existence of a supreme being." Now, this issue of whether politicians should be exempt from having their religious beliefs questioned, of course, is coming to a head with Mitt Romney and his Mormonism. Having accepted, as I say, the total constitutional rightness that nobody should be debarred from standing for election because of religion, have voting individuals the right to examine the religious beliefs of a candidate in making up their own mind in the ballot box whether or not to vote for him. There are a lot of Americans who think that the constitutional prohibition against a religious test means you can't even talk about a person's religion when deciding whether to vote. Journalists can't ask questions about it, can't discuss it, and so on. And I think that's nonsense, although many Americans disagree with me on this. I'm using Romney as an example for the general thesis I want to advance, which is, as I say, unpopular with Americans because they wrongly think it goes against their constitution. As I say, I think voters are entitled to take account of what a candidate is capable of believing, even if he doesn't let his beliefs interfere with his policies in any way. Mitt Romney believes that the Book of Mormon is a sacred book translated by a 19th century American called Joseph Smith, whom Romney reveres as a prophet, the founder of his Mormon faith. Mormons, including Romney, believe that Smith was guided by an angel, Moroni, to dig up some golden plates on which were written characters of an ancient language which he called Reformed Egyptian. He put a seer stone in a hat, buried his face in the hat, and looked at the seer stone. One by one, characters of Reformed Egyptian would appear in the stone, together with the English translation. Smith would say the English word, which would be written down by a scribe sitting behind a curtain. The scribe repeated the word, and when Smith approved it, the stone would display a new word in its place, and so on until all 531 pages of the book had been written down in English. The English of 1830, the English that Smith and his followers would naturally have spoken? No, not at all. Listen to some of it. First of all, there's a picture of the Book of Mormon. Notice the extraordinary resemblance to the King James Bible in its general appearance. You need to know in the bit I'm going to read to you that the land Bountiful refers to America. This passage describes the visit, which Mormons believe in, including Mitt Romney, Jesus Christ visited America. This is from 3 Nephi 11. And now it came to pass that there were a great multitude gathered together of the people of Nephi round about the temple which was in the land Bountiful. And they were marveling and wondering one with another. And it came to pass that while they were thus conversing one with another, they heard a voice as if it came out of heaven. And they cast their eyes round about, for they understood not the voice which they heard. And it was not a harsh voice, neither was it a loud voice. Nevertheless, and notwithstanding it being a small voice, it did pierce them that did hear to the centre, insomuch as there was no part of their frame that it did not cause to quake. Yea, it did pierce them to the very soul, and did cause their hearts to burn. This was written in the 19th century, you understand. And it came to pass that again they heard the voice, and they understood it not. And behold, the third time they did understand the voice which they heard, and it said unto them, Behold, my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, in whom I have glorified my name, hear ye him. Why would a 19th century man translate from an alleged ancient book, translate into 16th century English? What's going on there? And it came to pass, by the way, Mark Twain remarked that if you took out every instance of it came to pass from the Book of, from the Book of Mormon, it would be reduced to a pamphlet. And it came to pass, as they understood, they cast their eyes up again towards heaven, and behold, they saw a man descending out of heaven, and he was clothed in a white robe, and he came down and stood in the midst of them, and the eyes of the whole multitude were turned upon him, and they durst not open their mouths. Nobody in the 19th century said durst. Even one to another, and wist not what it meant, for they thought it was an angel that had appeared unto them. And it came to pass that he stretched forth his hand and spake unto the people, saying, Behold, I am Jesus Christ, whom the prophets testified shall come into the world. And behold, I am the light and the life of the world, and I have drunk out of that bitter cup which the Father hath given me, and have glorified the Father in taking upon me the sins of the world, in the which have I suffered the will of the Father in all things from the beginning. And it came to pass that the Lord spake unto them, saying, Arise and come forth unto me, that ye may thrust your hands into my side, and also that ye may... It's plagiarized from the King James Version, transferred to America. Mitt Romney believes that that is the work of a prophet. He believes that it was that Jesus really did visit America. By the way, before any of this happened, to sort of build up this picture of gullibility, Joseph Smith already had a track record in the area as a charlatan, a psychic diviner of buried treasure. He claimed to be able to see underground, looking for treasure, by looking through his hat. Everything about the Book of Mormon reeks of fake. Joseph Smith was an obvious charlatan. That's not an interesting fact itself. It doesn't matter. There have been numerous charlatans down the ages. The point is that Mitt Romney, candidate for the job of most powerful man in the world, with his finger on the nuclear button, is a gullible fool who believes Joseph Smith. And it seems to me entirely right that journalists and voters should question him on his Mormon beliefs, and he should not be allowed to hide behind the privacy of religion and say, that's my private business, that's nothing to do with you. Now, I've been tweeting about this lately, and the commonest retort I get is, why are you down on Romney? Isn't Obama's Christianity just as ridiculous? Well, first of all, I think there's a very good chance that Obama's actually an atheist. At least the fact that he professes Christianity means absolutely nothing. He's an elected American politician, and if you fail to profess some kind of religion, you're not an elected American politician, you're unelected. Even if Obama is Christian, which I put at about 50-50, he's of course not the same kind of Christian who believes in Adam and Eve or any of that nonsense. If he's a Christian at all, he's the kind of Christian who regards biblical miracles as symbolic or metaphorical rather than literally true. There seems no doubt, however, that Romney really is a proper, devout, true-believing Mormon. He was a zealous Mormon bishop. A woman has recounted how, after she left the Mormon church, Bishop Romney showed up on her doorstep in order to excommunicate her. She had already left of her own accord. Somewhat officious, presumptuous to excommunicate her. But perhaps Romney is a reformed character since his bishop days. But in an even more obnoxious reprise of the same kind of presumptuousness, he posthumously baptized, this is the charming Mormon custom, he baptized posthumously his father-in-law, who had been a strong atheist. He baptized him 14 months after his death. I think it's pretty clear Romney is a strong, believing Mormon. Christianity, even fundamentalist Christianity, I think I would submit is substantially less ridiculous than Mormonism. As I say, if Obama's a Christian at all, he's not fundamentalist. Christian scriptures are genuinely ancient. The translations from Hebrew and Greek that Christians use are in a language contemporary with the translators. The Book of Mormon is not ancient. The language of its alleged translation is ludicrously anachronistic. was dictated by Joseph Smith, as I say, a man with a track record of charlatanry, into using a magic stone and a magic hat into anachronistic English. Setting aside the mountebankery of Smith's own story, many of the core beliefs of Mormonism seem to me to be measurably more ridiculous than those of Christianity. To run counter to everything we now know for certain, for example, about the colonization of America. DNA evidence utterly refutes the claim that Native Americans are a remnant of the House of Israel. The idea that Jesus visited America is archaeologically preposterous. The idea that Adam and Eve did too is even worse. At least it's arguable that Jesus existed. The traditional Mormon belief in the inferiority of black people, only recently renounced for reasons of political expediency, is as scientifically inaccurate as it is obnoxious. The great prophet Brigham Young even prescribed the death penalty for interracial marriage. The belief in a star called Kolob, which is close to the throne of God, runs, of course, against all astronomy. It's hard to think of any Christian beliefs that are quite as daft as any of those. Perhaps the one good candidate is the Roman Catholic belief that bread and wine literally become the body and blood of Christ. And I think it's a perfectly legitimate question that anybody should put to any Roman Catholic, including candidates for office. Do you really believe that the bread and wine literally is the body and blood of Christ? I like to think that Kennedy would have said, no, of course I don't. In which case the retort would be, well, why do you call yourself Roman Catholic? It does seem to me that if somebody is going to call themselves Catholic or Mormon or whatever it is, they should only do so if they're prepared to stand up for the core beliefs of that religion. And the rest of us should be entitled to ask them whether they really do believe it. And if they really do believe it, then we are entitled as voters to be skeptical of their judgment, of their gullibility, of their judgment in making other decisions, other choices, other important matters of state, if they are so credulous, so gullible, so downright stupid as to believe some of the things, for example, that Mormons believe. Do you want to have a man with his finger on the nuclear button who is capable of believing that Joseph Smith, the charlatan, was a divinely inspired prophet? Now, I said that I would return to Tony Blair and just have a bit of fun at the end of what's been, I think, a very good day. Tony Blair, as I said, waited until he retired in order to do God. And it happens that by a roundabout route, a document came into my hands, a letter from the fundraiser of the Tony Blair Foundation. And I published this letter in New Statesman magazine a few months ago. I'm going to read a bit of it. Dear person of faith, basically, I write as fundraiser for the wonderful new Tony Blair Foundation, whose aim is to promote respect and understanding about the world's major religions and show how faith is a powerful force for good in the modern world. I would like to touch base with you on six key points from the recent New Statesman piece by Tony, as he likes to be called by everybody of all faiths, or indeed of none, for that's how tuned in he is. So the first of these key points from Tony Blair, and these bits are true, by the way, the bits on the slide are true, not my own interpolation. My faith has always been an important part of my politics. Yes, indeed, although Tony modestly kept shtum about it when he was Prime Minister. As he said, to shout his faith from the rooftops might have been interpreted as claiming moral superiority over those with no faith, and therefore no morals, of course. Also, some might have objected to their leader taking advice from voices only he could hear. But hey, reality is so last year, compared with private revelation, isn't it? What else, other than shared faith, could have brought Tony together with his friend and comrade in arms, George Mission Accomplished Bush in their life-saving and humanitarian intervention in Iraq. Admittedly, there are one or two problems remaining to be ironed out there, but all the more reason for people of different faiths, Christian and Muslim, Sunni and Shia, to join together in meaningful dialogue to seek common ground, just as Catholics and Protestants have done so heartwarmingly throughout European history. It is these great benefits of faith that the Tony Blair Foundation seeks to promote. We are focusing on five main projects, initially working with partners in the six main faiths. Yes, I know, it's a pity we had to limit ourselves to six, but we do have boundless respect for other faiths, all of which in their colourful variety enrich human lives. In a very real sense, we have much to learn from Zoroastrianism and Jainism, and from Mormonism, though Cherie says we need to go easy on the polygamy and the sacred underpants. Then again, we mustn't forget the ancient and rich Olympian and Norse traditions. Although our modern blue skies thinking out of the box has pushed the envelope on shock and awe tactics and put Zeus's thunderbolts and Thor's hammer in the shade. We hope in phase two of our five-year plan to embrace Scientology and Druidic mistletoe worship, which in a very real sense have something to teach us all. In phase three, our firm commitment to diversity will lead us to source new networking partnership opportunities with the many hundreds of African tribal religions. Sacrificing goats may present problems with the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, but we hope to persuade them to adjust their priorities to take proper account of religious sensibilities. We are working across religious divides towards a common goal, ending the scandal of deaths from malaria. Plus, of course, we mustn't forget the countless deaths from AIDS. This is where we can learn from the Pope's inspiring vision, expounded recently on his visit to Africa. Drawing on his reserves of scientific and medical knowledge, informed and deepened by the values that only faith can bring, His Holiness explained that the scourge of AIDS is made worse, not better, by condoms. His advocacy, that's totally true, by the way, his advocacy of abstinence may have dismayed some medical experts, and the same goes for his deeply and sincerely held opposition to stem cell research. But surely, to goodness, we must find room for a diverse range of opinions. All opinions, after all, are equally valid. And there are many ways of knowing, spiritual as well as factual. That, at the end of the day, is what the Tony Blair Foundation is all about. We have established Face to Faith, an interfaith schools program to counter intolerance and extremism. The great thing is to foster diversity, as Tony himself said in 2002, when challenged by a rather intolerant MP about a school in Gateshead, teaching children that the world is only 6,000 years old. Of course, you may think, as Tony himself happens to, that the true age of the world is 4.6 billion years. But excuse me, in this multicultural world, we must find room to tolerate and indeed actively foster all opinions. The more diverse, the better. We are looking to set up video conferencing dialogues to brainstorm our differences. By the way, that Gateshead school ticked lots of boxes when it came to GCSE results, which just goes to show. Children of one faith and culture will have the chance to interact with children of another, getting a real sense of each other's lived experience. Cool! And thanks to Tony's policy of putting as many children as possible in faith schools, where they can't befriend kids from other backgrounds, the need for this interaction and mutual understanding has never been so strong. You see how it all hangs together? Sheer genius. So strongly do we support the principle that children should be sent to schools that will identify them with their parents' beliefs, we think there is a real opportunity here to broaden it out. In phase two, we look to facilitate separate schools for postmodernist children, Leavisite children, Saussurean structuralist children. And in phase three, we shall roll out yet more separate schools for Keynesian children, monetarist children, and even neo-Marxist children. Finally, we are working with the Coexist Foundation and Cambridge University to develop the concept of Abraham House. I always think it's so important to coexist, don't you, with our brothers and sisters of the other Abrahamic faiths? Of course we have our differences. I mean, who doesn't, basically? But we must all learn mutual respect. For example, we need to understand and sympathize with the deep hurt and offense that a man can feel if we insult his traditional beliefs by trying to stop him beating his wife, or setting fire to his daughter, or cutting off her clitoris. And please don't let's hear any racist or Islamophobic objections to these important expressions of faith. We shall support the introduction of Sharia courts, but on a strictly voluntary basis, only for those whose husbands and fathers freely choose it. The Tony Blair Foundation will work to leverage mutual respect and understanding between seemingly incompatible faith traditions. After all, despite our differences, we do have one important thing in common. All of us in the faith communities hold firm beliefs in the total absence of evidence, which leaves us free to believe anything we like. So, at the very least, we can be united in claiming a privileged role for all these private beliefs in the formulation of public policy. I hope this letter will have shown you some of the reasons why you might consider supporting Tony's foundation. Because, hey, let's face it, a world without religion doesn't have a prayer. With so many of the world's problems caused by religion, what better solution could there possibly be than to promote yet more of it? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have some questions, please? Right, okay, let's start over there, please, with the chap with his hand up. Yep, that's that one. Thank you very much.
Richard, you must encounter many other scientists and other people who you respect and admire for their intellect and their achievements, but who nevertheless profess religious belief. How do you personally explain or attempt to understand that mystery?
I think the first thing to say is that is when you meet such a person, ask them what they actually believe. Very often you'll find that they are in some vague sense spiritual. They will say something like, when I look up at the Milky Way, I'm filled with a feeling of exaltation in the chest, which means there must be something more than science understands. Of course, I have exactly that same feeling. Something more than science yet understands. That's very different from saying that because science doesn't yet understand it, well, it might mean science will never understand it, but even then, it's very different from saying because science doesn't understand it, therefore religion does. And so I think you'll find that the great majority of those scientists whom you respect who profess religious belief actually are more what you might call vaguely spiritual. Those that go a bit further and say, I actually do believe in Christianity or almost never Islam, but let's say Christianity or Judaism, then again ask them exactly what they believe. They might believe, that Jesus was a good person. Well, yes, he was a good person. If you actually pin them down and say, do you believe that Jesus died for your sins? Do you believe that you're going to go to heaven or hell when you die? Then I think you'll find that the number of respectable scientists who actually believe it is very, very low indeed. There have been surveys done of both the Royal Society and also the American equivalent, which is the National Academy of Sciences, both gave very similar results, that the number of elite scientists belonging to these elite groups of scientists who believe in some sort of religion is about 10%. About 90% don't. So that would be my answer to that.
Thank you. the chap here with his hand up. Keep your hand up, please, so people can find you.
Hi. My first ever experience with religious privilege was at school, secondary school, and I noticed the uniform code would be very, very strict about what people have to wear. No jewellery, no hats, nothing like that. Yeah, I noticed that people were allowed to wear headscarves, they were allowed to wear bangles, and that, for me, so people weren't allowed to wear any hats, but headscarves would be allowed. And whilst actually that's not a religious obligation, for example, by Islam or Sikhism to wear bangles, but again, they were allowed. And it seemed to me like a very odd discrepancy, and it hasn't been actually something that I've seen promoted or discussed by the NSS as part of their campaigns, because it's such a sensitive issue, I think. Do you think it's right to have exceptions for religion in an environment like a school, or do you think there should be a rule for everyone, either uniform or no uniform, full stop?
Well, I don't feel that strongly about uniforms anyway, but I think if there's some reason for having a uniform, like whether it's military, maybe there is a reason for having school uniform, maybe there is a reason for nurses to have a uniform, or for airline stewards and stewardesses to have a uniform, then I'm not a great enthusiasm for allowing religious exceptionalism, for saying, oh, nobody else is allowed to wear a hat or a necklace or whatever it is, but religious people are. And therefore, I'm not that moved by the distinction between religions that insist upon a particular kind of garment and those that don't. I would be opposed, I think others have said this today as well, I think I'm opposed to the French law banning the wearing of bin liners. I think that is an infringement of freedom. So I don't go along with that. But I think that if an institution like an airline, for example, has a rule that religion should not be regarded as reason for exemption. If everybody objected to the rule, if everybody said, I want to wear a necklace, and managed to win their case, that would be different. In the case of the British Airways stewardess, who I think is now fighting a case in the European Court of Human Rights, she was allowed to wear her crucifix inside her uniform, where only God could see it. But she insisted that she wanted to wear it outside, because she wanted to proselytize to the passengers, and that seems to me to be taking exceptionalism to grant religious exception to that. That seems to me to be wrong.
Thank you. We've got time only for one or two more questions. Are there any women in the audience that want to ask a question? Put your hand down if you're a man, please, and leave your hand up if you're a woman. Right. I've got one there. In the centre of the aisle, keep your hand up, please. Thank you very much. Could you get a microphone to her? Thank you very much indeed.
I think many of us have at some point in our lives asked if people are allowed to profess that God has no creator, then how do you argue against, the question is, how do you argue that if God can go without being created, why can't the universe?
You put it so well.
really?
I have no problem with that argument. It is, of course, the origin of the universe is one of the most profound questions facing physics at the moment, and physicists are actively working on the question. I recommend Lawrence Krauss's book, A Universe from Nothing. But the general point is that the point you've just made is that however difficult it may be for physics to answer questions like where did the laws of physics come from, where did the universe originally come from, however difficult that may be, it certainly isn't going to help to say that a designer designed it, for the obvious reason that you have mentioned. It's an infinite regress, and if you're going to allow that God, the creator, is somehow exempt from needing explanation, then you might as well say the same thing of the universe.
Thank you. And we're running a bit low on time, so I'm going to take one last question from the woman there with her hand up. Yeah, no, put your hand back up. Yes, it's you. That's it. Thank you.
I was just wondering, what do you think could be done to stop children being categorized in the faith of their parents, as I know that is a, sort of a big issue?
Well, you may know this is an issue that's very dear to my heart, and I satirized it in my satire on Tony Blair's foundation by saying, what about special schools for postmodernist children and secular humanist children and Gramsci and Marxist children and so on? I think that the one thing, if only we could wave a magic wand and break the cycle of influence, of passing on of religion automatically from parent to child, or even break the cycle of assuming that a child is going to be of the religion of its parents. I mean, when people talk about people who are frightened, alarmist perhaps, about the spread of Islam, and they use a demographic argument, looking at reproductive rates in different countries and things, the hidden assumption is that all children are automatically going to belong to the same religion as their parents. Why do we allow the world to get away with that assumption? Even if it's realistic, it's something we ought to be fighting against. And the questioner asks, what can we do to fight against it without being dictatorial? I mean, I've been accused of wanting to seize children away from their parents and put them in collective farms or something. I don't want to do that at all. I don't want to do anything by coercion. The weapon I favour is consciousness raising. It's somehow, well, ridicule is part of it, and I tried to ridicule the idea, as I said, of Keynesian children and monetarist children. I mean, people get that once you point out that nobody ever talks about an existentialist child. Why not? You talk about a Catholic child when you really mean a child of Catholic parents. Why not talk about an existentialist child? We never do. Religion is given a free pass. Religion is given a free pass to label a child with the religion of its parents as though it was an automatic given, an automatic assumption that a child will inherit the religion of its parents. And if we could only raise people's consciousness to what they're doing when they make that assumption, raise consciousness like this, whenever at a dinner party, any kind of conversation you're having, if you ever hear the phrase Catholic child, Protestant child, Muslim child, etc., stop them and say, how dare you use that phrase Catholic child? The child is too young to know. What you're talking about is a child of Catholic parents. And if only everybody would do that, if only we could make that meme spread like the common cold, so that people don't let through that outrageous presumption that a child should be automatically labelled with the religion of its parents, we might be able to raise consciousness and stop journalists using the presumption, stop ordinary people using the presumption, above all, stop religious propagandists and politicians from doing it, which they regularly do. Thank you.
And a beautiful ending. Thank you. Please give a round of applause to Professor Richard Dawkins.
This was a special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine programme about interesting things, from politics to science to culture, all from a sceptical rationalist, pro-secularist point of view. Essentially, if you like what you've just heard, then you'll like our weekly podcast as well. Head over to poddelusion.co.uk to find out more. But for now, thanks for listening.